It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimera's Comics. Chimera's is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimera's Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. We got a Skype call for you. This week, it's artist Graham Nolan. You may remember Graham as the co-creator of Bane and the main artist on Detective Comics through much of the 90s, one of the best times for Batman, in my opinion. During that time, he was paired with Chuck Dixon, who's a friend of the show. You may have heard him on his previous appearances. And it was during one of those conversations when we were talking about Batman, I asked, do you think Graham might be interested in coming on the show? And he said, I'm sure he'd love to. And so I got to know Graham on Facebook, and sure enough, he wanted to come on the show. What follows is a really great conversation, and a different kind of conversation that we've had before. We've never had an artist, and I didn't realize that until after Graham and I were talking. So we get into things like process, and what inkers he likes, and how he works. Graham and Chuck both won Inkpot Awards at San Diego Comic-Con this year, which was a great honor and one they didn't expect. So we get into that, and then we also talk about some of Graham's other projects. He's got some upcoming limited series, and he's got his webcomic Sunshine State. It's a really fun conversation, and let's just get to it. First of all, I want to congratulate you on the Inkpot this year at San Diego.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, was that a surprise? Because I saw it came during the Batman panel. Did you know about that
beforehand? Yeah, it was a surprise. No. The surprise is all the way around. I mean, Denny was supposed to moderate it, and he didn't realize he was supposed to moderate it until he got there. So I guess somebody grabbed him aside and said, look, you know, we have some awards to give out too. And so when Denny announced that, I turned to Kelly and I turned to Chuck, and I'm like, what is this? You know, we thought, well, maybe they'll give us, you know, some bags or lanyards or, you know, Comic-Con stuff.
You can come back next year.
We didn't know what it was, you know. And then when they announced it as an Inkpot Award, you know, for your contributions to the comic arts and stuff, we're three of us, right? And we're just dumbfounded.
That's fantastic. And the Inkpot, it's like a lifetime achievement award, isn't it?
Yeah. I liken if the Eisner is the Academy Award, mm-hmm. the Inkpot is more like the AFI Award.
Oh, nice.
You know, so it kind of does encompass, you know, all the stuff you've done in your career, type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that it came at the Batman panel and that Kelly Jones was a part of it obviously means your run on Batman in the 90s was a heavy focus.
Yeah, well, they didn't say particularly, you know, what it was, but, you know, I'm quite sure that, you know, our biggest contributions came there.
Right, and that was a long run. I know you and Chuck did Detective for, was it 7 or 8 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it was, well, Chuck did, he was on it before I was, so he's got an extra, and then he was on it, I think, a year after I left also. So I think he's got a couple years on me.
Right. But yeah, because he was doing some of the other books. I know he's, mm-hmm. when we talked, I know he started on Robin, and I think when he left, he was still doing Robin. But your guys run on Detective was, now was that your first work in the Batman office?
Detective?
Yeah. Did you get the monthly first? Cause I know Vengeance of Bane is very close to the start of your run.
Yeah, no, I think I got, you know, that's so long ago, it's hard to remember. The first thing I did, actually, you know what, I did a couple fill-in issues. I did three issues, 650, 651, 652, and I think 653. So I guess I did four fill-in issues, and then I got Vengeance of Bane.
Okay, so Vengeance of Bane is before you got Detective as a monthly.
Yes.
Okay. Now, when I was talking to Chuck,
at least that's the way I remember it.
Now, what were the when I talked to Chuck the first time about Bane, he said really the only mandates were to use Venom and because Venom came from Santa Prisca and Denny's story, that he would have kind of a Latin feel. How much did you and Chuck talk about it before you did the first design on him?
I had gotten notes from Chuck, you know, about what he had planned for Vengeance of Bane. So I kind of ran with that. There was a couple things that, as you mentioned, were dictated. One was the Venom, and we needed a delivery system for him. I came up with the idea of it might have said in Chuck's outline, like ports in the back of his head. But I knew that he had to like have a delivery system, so I came up with the idea of the tube going up the arm, and then he would press a button, and then it would, you know, inject it into him. And in fact, the belt that Bane wears, and I don't think it was ever shown in a comic, but the design of the belt, if you'll notice, is the same as the packets that go into his Venom delivery thing, because the belt was supposed to be his Venom packets. It wasn't just a design thing. So he would take the packet off the belt, slap it into the thing on his wrist, press the button, and zappo.
Oh, cause kind of like Spider-Man's web shooters.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow.
I don't think we ever showed that, but that was the design aspect. That's why the belt was designed the way it was. The mask was based on the Lucador masks of the Mexican wrestlers, because I figured if Bane was going to wear something, that would be about the only thing he'd ever be exposed to, you know, costume-wise, because of where he grew up. And then I tied in that wrestling motif into the singlet top. And then I went with kind of a Cuban revolutionary look for the boots and pants to kind of tie this whole Latin American thing in together.
Yeah, so you really try to follow the theme. And,
yeah, you know, I was trying to think, like, if I was Bane and I was in this prison and I was trying to design a costume for myself, where would my inspirations come from? So that's kind of how it came about. Now, Bane's mask originally was really more of a wrestling mask. The closest one that they ever portrayed was in the animated series, because I had his eyes open, his nose open, and his mouth open like a real wrestling mask, because my original thoughts were, if we want to see him emoting, you know, we could show the gritted teeth, you know, and show his eyes and all that kind of stuff. But editorial made the decision to make it more mysterious, so we covered it up.
Oh, really? Yeah, I remember that first Bruce Timm episode where there was a lot of lip sync. And they even cut out his nose in that original appearance.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost exactly like the original design of the mask.
Wow, did they know that, or was that a coincidence?
I'm assuming they must have known.
Mm-hmm.
They must have seen the original design. But, you know, I kind of agree with the idea of making it more mysterious. I think it's too much wrestling looking when all the features were exposed. So I think it was probably a good call to cover it up and make it more mysterious.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting how iconic that mask has become, at least in the comics, because even though they've done very different designs in live action and in animation, I noticed when you did the Bane one shot last year, the new 52 look looked very much like Tom Hardy's vest with your original mask.
Because when I did that thing, there was never they went into this whole new 52 thing and they didn't have anything. They didn't have it locked down. So the reference that they sent me for Bane, which is kind of funny that they got to send me reference, was all over the place. You know, sometimes he had these little dot red eyes, you know, peering out. Sometimes you'd see his skin. It just didn't have any continuity to it. So
yeah, I remember
when I got the assignment and I was asked.
There were a couple of early appearances where he really looked like the Arkham Asylum, the Arkham City video game designs.
Yeah, there was all these other influences coming through, and so I tried to kind of do a design that incorporated some of those things, but also kept the original. So I kept the original kind of eye shape type of thing, But I added the I don't know what to call it, but cheekbone bounce out on the white part of the mask, which is really, really dumb looking, if you ask me. But it was in a bunch of the reference, so I just kind of I kept it in there because when I asked them, can I just redesign this thing so everybody works from the same, you know, from the same model? They said, no, we put a lot of thought into this.
No creator of the character. We put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah, I don't know where the thought went, but
well, it didn't go back to the creator, apparently.
Yeah, no, it did not.
Well, that's an interesting thing too, because as we said, Bane's been portrayed so many different ways. How do you feel about how the changes they've made with it, especially say like Tom Hardy's performance in Dark Knight Rises?
Love Tom Hardy's performance. Did not like any of the design aspects of Bane.
Really?
Also, his the one big beef that both Chuck and I have with the character was they were moving along so nicely with him for a while there, and then at the end they got to tell us that Talia is really the brains behind everything, and it's like, oh, come on. Now, Bane's not going to, you know, kowtow to anybody, let alone Talia.
Right, and you guys had already done Bane of the Demon, which combined Bane with Talia. And he was more...
Exactly.
If I remember that story, he was more pushing up against Ra's al Ghul than listening to Talia.
Oh, absolutely. The Talia whole thing was like, he was like hot for teacher, you know? I mean, he was just after Talia the whole story, you know, and she was spurning him. But, you know, there's a great scene in that series where Bane is playing chess with Ra's al Ghul, but he's playing it on like 20 different chess boards, and they got 20 games going at all at the same time. You know, it just shows you the intellect and the brains and the strategy behind the character, which is really cool.
Right, I think that's the one thing that the movie did well with the character was they brought the intelligence back, as opposed to say Batman and Robin, which I'm sorry to bring up to you. Where he was essentially Frankenstein.
Yeah. I kind of like the way he looked. I mean, he had more of a traditional mask in that.
Yeah, it was like a gas mask mouth.
How does he eat with that thing on?
I think he could take it off. At some point, wouldn't he?
I guess. I mean, although, you know, they made it sound like if he takes it off, he's in agonizing pain, you know.
Well, then that's why he's in good shape. He doesn't eat very long.
Yeah.
He pops it open, takes one bite, slaps it back on.
That's right. Right. Just pure protein.
So from the Vengeance of Bane one-shot, you went to the monthlies. If I remember right, it was in the middle of Nightfall, so you kind of rejoined Bane in the middle of that story. But then... You stayed on until, I think,
it wasn't quite the middle. It had just started. There was only like two or three issues of Detective that had actually come out that was part of Nightfall that I hadn't been doing because I was already working on, I guess I was working on Vengeance of Bane. No, I couldn't have. Right, I'm not sure how that timeline falls out, but I know that when I did start on the Nightfall, was it 661? 661? Is that the first issue that I did? I think it was something like that. The Nightfall storyline had just pretty much started.
Right, yeah, I remember there's a couple of Norm Breyfogle issues in the beginning before you come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That whole series blurs together because of the balance between Batman and Detective. That it's like, I think it's...
Yeah.
It's possibly you're the third detective, but then the sixth in the story. But then, but I guess everything went well because you just stayed on. Were you getting the impression when you joined during Nightfall that the fill-ins were over and you were the regular artist, or was it month to month?
No. They had told me, they offered it to me at one point when I finished Vengeance of, I guess it was when I finished Vengeance of Bane. They said they'd like to offer me the monthly detective. I'm like, okay.
Sounds good.
Yeah,
it's
now
a dream job.
Yeah, and actually yours and Chuck's run of that detective I think is one of the best Batman runs, in my opinion. And I always loved how you're welcome. Speaking of Kelly Jones, how you guys, what you were doing was so different than what Doug mentioned Kelly Jones were doing. But it still seemed to fit within the same universe. Was there discussion of we're going to go in this direction, you go in this direction? Or did Denny just kind of pick the guys that would kind of form a tone?
Well, when Kelly came on board, Nightfall was long over. Kelly was there for the covers.
Right.
He didn't come on Batman as the interior artist till all that stuff was all done.
Yeah, but when...
So the Nightfall storyline was complete.
Right. But when he comes on, was there talk at a Bat Summit of like you guys since you're a detective, you're going to do a grounded approach, or is it just because of you're in Chuck Stiles that it turned out that way? Cuz your stories were much more down to earth.
Yeah, well, I think that was a little of both because Chuck and I wanted to do detective stories. You know, we were offered the Batman title at one point, and we both turned it down because we wanted to stay on detective. Because A, it was Batman's launch pad. I mean, that was his flagship book. My dad was a detective, and it was like the first Batman comic I ever had was Detective Comics. So I kind of liked working on detective, and I wanted to do stories that focused on Batman using his smarts as a detective.
Mm-hmm. So do you think had you taken Batman, would you have had to change your approach?
I don't think so. I think we could have gone a little bit more superhero-y, because that always seemed to be the different flavor of Batman versus detective. The Batman in Batman was the Justice League Batman, and the Batman in Detective Comics was, the Sherlock Holmes detective.
Right, and there seemed to be Batman. more of a focus with your run on the gangster level villains, more of yes. Penguin and Riddler than Mr. Freeze and Clayface.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we actually never used either of those characters.
Are there standouts from that run other than the big events? Are there stories that you still look back on and remember?
Yes.
Can you tell me one?
There's, two of them actually. Both Chuck and I love the Captain Fear story. It was a two-parter, and it's funny. We talked about this at the when they gave us the Inkpot Award that. As much as we love that, the editors hated it. They couldn't stand that story that we did because to us it was like the perfect Batman story. It was Batman with a really cool trap that he was stuck in because he was tied to a buoy and he was bleeding and sharks were coming at him. We introduced a new costumed character villain, called Captain Fear, who had this pirate motif going on. So it had all the great... trappings of a Batman story, had him being a detective, using all his toys, an escape trap, a new villain, all this kind of stuff. And the editors just thought it was like too much like the TV show, I don't know. We still can't figure out why they didn't like that story because we both loved it.
and still in the execution?
So that one, and
when it was published, you were like, no, we still love this? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, we still, I still look back at that one and think, oh man, I love this story. The other one was the Penguin story arc, where we revamped the Penguin in instead of the top hat and the tails kind of guy, we kind of reinvented him as a Casper Gutman type person, like from the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, let's. I'd love to get into more detail about that because that really stuck. I mean, you see that still in the New 52 and in the video games that Penguin's the go between the legitimate world and the gangster world now. Did you guys talk about that for a long time about what to do with the Penguin and how to revamp him to make him more vital to Gotham City?
Yeah, it actually came about accidentally. We were at one of the Bat Summits, and we were sitting at a table at lunch or something like that. And we were kind of talking about with some of these big events ending, you know, that we're going to get to do standalone stories, you know, what villains do we want to use, that kind of stuff. And Chuck had mentioned using the Penguin. I said, oh, yeah, that's great. And he had an idea for the Penguin to kind of like make him a little bit different. And I forget what it was, but I said, wait a minute, what if he was like Casper Gutman, you know, and he wears the white suit, you know, that whole thing, you know, where it's a dinner suit, that type of thing. And then from that, then Chuck came up with the idea of what was the lounge? The Polar Lounge?
The Iceberg Lounge.
The Iceberg Lounge. Yeah, he came up with the Iceberg Lounge as a place for the Penguin to meet, you know, to meet his underworld people and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of bounced like back and forth, like a lot of stuff that we work on together, you know, where somebody has an idea, another one jumps on it, and then we kind of like tweak it, and that's how it came about.
Yeah, because that stuck. Not only has that stuck to this day, but that got picked up by everybody right away. I remember during Batman the Animated Series, they started using the Iceberg Lounge, and
right,
that version of Penguin. So yeah, I know you and Chuck have been working together for a long time. Do you usually have a conversation before and then receive a script? Are you talking about the longer story arcs and then you're getting it written down on paper, or is it more of or is it looser at this point where you're talking and breaking down the story verbally?
It depends on what we're working on. We just finished a project for Graphics India together that I had no input in. You know, the story was being determined by Chuck and the guys in India, and I got the script for it and worked on it that way. But then there's other things where we work on, like when we did the Joker Devil's Advocate, where we sat down and co-plotted the whole thing together. You know, we had these little cue cards and stuff, and I'd write down scenes, and we put them in orders and all that kind of stuff and move it around. So it kind of depends on what the project is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Devil's Advocate is a really underrated story. I wondered at the time, because that came out kind of during your detective run, how did you have the time to do that? That was like a 64-page graphic novel. Did you take time off from detective?
Well, there's some holes in my run as detective where I took time off to do Devil's Advocate, and I took time off to do Superman the Odyssey. Trying to think if there's something else that I took time off for. I think those are the two big ones where there was a gap in run.
Yeah, your presence was so strong. I cannot remember you not being there. I think it was also the point where you had set such a tone that they weren't going to get somebody wildly different to step in, I'm assuming.
Well, you know, one of the things that was bugging me about the books was that there was no continuity in all of the Batman-related stuff. So, like, somebody would come in and they would, you know, there's four different Bat books at any one time, maybe five if you include Robin. And so if somebody's drawing the Bat Cave, he's drawing a computer system that he's made up, and another guy's doing another one, and Wayne Manor is looking different, and all this other stuff. So I had said to Scott Peterson, why don't we create a Bible? You know, why don't we do, you know, why don't I sit down and do some designs? Because I was kind of like the Batman historian of the group. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew all the history, particularly the Golden Age Batman stuff. So I started off with designing the trophy room, which was a ball because I put in all kinds of obscure reference of trophies from stories that I love that nobody's going to remember, but it's going to look really cool in there.
Well, it's kind of like the giant penny and the dinosaur today. Nobody knows what they're from. Unless maybe you, knowing the Golden Age.
Oh, I know, because I wrote stories, because I pitched the idea of doing a Tales of the Bat Cave, which would explain how all these trophies. And so the first two stories that I wrote and illustrated was The Penny Plunderer, which is how we got the giant penny, and then Dinosaur Island.
So and were those
I used the same titles and the same character names, but I changed the plots and stories and created something new and modern to explain why he has these trophies.
Oh, that's cool. Where did that run?
They ran in Batman Chronicles, I think is what it was.
So,
I had more that I wanted to do, but the editors, my editors left by then.
Yeah, Chuck talked about that, how it was kind of a sea change of the bad offices.
What? Yeah.
Now, but talking about your love in the Golden Age, who are your influences?
For Batman?
Yeah, but just artistically and storytelling.
Oh, I guess storytelling influences are the guys that did really good sequential stuff. Guys like Will Eisner, strip guys like Robbins and Kniff. Roy Crane is one of my all-time favorite cartoonists. Then there's the more modern guys, you know, the Buscemas, the Kirbys, the Romitas, you know, that I really, really love. Kubert, another one.
Yeah, I always noticed a little bit of Romita in your figure work, and I was wondering if that was a conscious influence.
Probably. I don't see it, even though Romita was such a huge influence on me. Mm-hmm. Chuck says that the biggest influence he sees in my work is Garcia Lopez.
Okay. Yeah.
And when he says that, I can see it because, you know, I take a linear approach to the figure the way that Garcia Lopez does. I can definitely see. I'm nowhere near as good as him, mind you, but I can see the influence.
I can see it in your Batman. I think you lean towards the kind of leaner body type and the very soft swooping cape that I think of him even more than Neil Adams or Marshall Rogers of that style.
As far as like my Batman influences go, they're pretty. They're pretty set in stone. It was Don Newton,
okay,
Dick Sprang, and Jim Aparo.
Oh, interesting. I can see the Don Newton and the Jim Aparo. Where do you see the Sprang? Because Sprang is so – he's got such a signature style, and it's so 50s. Where did you see it coming out in your work?
I guess I don't know where it comes out in the work, other than the cartoony aspect of it, because my work tends to have a flavor of cartoonism, of cartoon approach to it, as opposed to illustration.
Mm-hmm.
Like Don Newton, Neil Adams, those guys are more illustrative, if you will,
right,
than me. But Romita. You know, he's a guy that has the cartoon flavor to his work because he was influenced by Kniff and Sickles and that whole crew. So I think, of course, Chester Gould and Dick Sprang are from that camp. And so I feel that's where the Sprang comes from is the cartoon approach that I put into things, like maybe small figures in the background. Robin, certainly, when I draw him, I kind of think of Dick Sprang a little bit.
And that's interesting. And the cartooniness, I think, leads me to Sunshine State, because your work always seems so grounded to me and so down to earth, and especially in Batman, so geared in drama that when I initially saw Sunshine State, I thought it was a very hard shift. But now that you're telling me about the kind of that layer of cartooniness, it's almost like you're just letting that side of yourself go free.
Yeah, I describe myself as a cartoonist, not an illustrator, because I work with words and pictures. That's pretty much the definition of what a cartoonist is, you know. You have writers that, you know, they write prose. You've got illustrators that do single illustrations and drawings. But a cartoonist works with words and pictures. So I think that's the closest definition that I apply to myself. And so style aside, you know, cartooning is cartooning. You know, whether you do a humorous style like Sunshine State or you do a more dramatic style like Batman, you know, you still approach it from a cartoonist's point of view, I think.
Yeah. Now, where did Sunshine State come from?
Well, I grew up in my junior high and high school years down in Florida. And I consider that my hometown because that's where my formative years were, you know, as a young man. So the characters are pretty much extensions of my own personality. Each one of them has an aspect of me. Mel, the alligator, he's kind of conservative. He likes he likes old stuff. And then Dink is the pelican. He's more progressive. Loves technology. I love technology. He loves 70s disco. I like 70s disco. You know? So there's aspects of my personality that goes into each one of those characters, and then there's also the Florida or the Everglades being a fourth character there, and my experiences, you know, living in the Sunshine State, you know.
And was the strip something, was a wish you always wanted to see fulfilled after so many years of comic books?
You know, I always wanted to be a comic book artist. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write and illustrate comic books. Because I never really read the comic strips in the newspaper too much. There were a few, but you know, I was locked into comic books. But then as the years went on, you know, I started developing this idea of a syndicated strip. I wanted to do, you know, let some of my humor come out. And you know, I grew up in an Irish family where, you know, they're good storytellers and lots of laughs and humor. And so I wanted to kind of have an outlet to show that.
Now you talked a lot about your Batman influences and your storytelling influences, and you mentioned some of the strip artists, but they were more action. Who are your humor influences?
Russell Myers, who does Broomhilda.
Mm-hmm.
That guy, he's still got it. I mean, I don't know how old he is. He's got to be 70-something years old now, because that strip came out in the early 70s.
Yeah, those comic strip guys, they just work until, like Charles Schultz, he handed in his last strip like 3 days before he passed away.
Yeah, yeah. Johnny Hart died at the drawing board.
Wow.
You know, the daily deadline is unforgiving. It's really, really hard. You know, I did two strips for King Features, Rex Morgan, MD, and The Sunday Phantom. And, you know, it just grinds on you. It is a grind. You know, like in a comic book, when you finish a project, you can go, you know, slap your hands, dust the, get the dirt off, clean up the studio, kind of like celebrate the finish. You know, it's an exclamation point at the end of the sentence. Whereas, you know, the daily strip is just like a run-on sentence that never ends.
Yeah, there's always going to be another day.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you're feeling good? You got today's done? Well, there's tomorrow.
Yeah, and workload is it, because doing three panels instead of a page, is it pretty much the same workload?
No. Like when I was doing Rex, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a week's worth is like 3 or 4 pages, I guess. A Sunday is similar to a regular comic book page. But there's huge restrictions with the format. You can't – certain things you can and cannot do in a strip.
Yeah, you can't make bigger panels.
No, no. you can if they're proportional. They're going to shrink them anyway. But you know, like with the Sunday feature – there has to be certain breaks. There's certain formats. So a panel has to break. You know, you've got three tiers. You can't bust out of those tiers because not every newspaper runs it in a half-page format. So they have to cut it and format it, like you'll see in a newspaper strips it running vertical versus horizontal, and it's because they have these breaks when you're designing the page. It has to break in certain spots, and that's very restrictive. Mm-hmm. And you don't have you can hardly ever do a vertical panel, you know. So like if you were trying to show this a sense of height or depth or something like that, forget about it, you know. You're stuck in a widescreen format.
Right. Which do you prefer, or are they just different?
I prefer comic books.
Yeah, is it the freedom?
The format. Yeah, a lot more freedom. You've got this piece of canvas, you know, that you can put panels in any way you want. Choose the angles, choose the length and shapes. Not have panel borders at all. Have stuff bursting out of things. It's a lot more freeing from a design aspect.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned you and Chuck just finished a project. Which project is that?
You blanked out on me there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could you repeat the question?
Yeah, you mentioned that you and Chuck had just finished a project where he gave you the full script.
Oh yeah, it's for Graphic India. They're producing. I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say about it. They haven't announced it yet, so
okay.
Seem to be playing it close to the vest. But they just said that we can announce this. It's a large worldwide project that we worked on. And that's okay. About all I can say at this point.
I made you nervous.
Well, I started running off at the mouth there, and then I realized, maybe I better not say anything. They haven't announced it, and there's some licensing issues, so.
Okay. But is that the next thing you're working on?
No, I finished. Actually, the next thing I'm working on, after Joe Frankenstein,
okay,
which is
good.
What I'm working on.
That's what I thought we were talking about, and I didn't want to say Joe Frankenstein. If you weren't allowed to talk about it.
Let's talk about Joe Frankenstein. Let's talk about him. Yeah, I mean, that's for IDW.
Okay, great. Well, I've seen some of your pages on your Facebook feed. But, let's talk about that, because all I've really seen is the character designs and some panel work, and I'm already intrigued. Can you give me the premise of the book and what it's going to be?
Sure. Yeah, it's going to be a four-issue series published by IDW. Each book is going to be like 27 pages long, so it's going to be larger size. And it's a action adventure horror book about a boy who has been bounced in and out of foster homes his entire life. This kid named Joe Pratt, and he doesn't know anything about his past. And he's delivering pizzas in Buffalo one night, and he gets attacked by this coven of vampires. It's only through the intervention of this savior who comes bursting through the door, kills the vampires, and offers his hand to him and introduces himself as the Frankenstein monster, who's been watching over Joe and Joe's family for the last 300 years as an act of penance for the horrors that he committed when he was first created. So Joe finds out that he's the last heir of the Frankenstein name, and that the world is not what it seems to him, that, you know, there's these creatures and monsters that are out there, and a lot of them are after him, particularly the bride of the monster, because she does not have the gift of eternal life like the monster has. Dr. Frankenstein did not want to make that mistake twice, so he did not give that gift to her. But he encoded the secret to eternal life. The secret to eternal life is in the monster's blood. But the codex needed to decipher it is in the bloodline. Is in his bloodline. So that's why she is after Joe. She needs his blood to figure out the secret of eternal life. And now she's found out where he is, and she's after him. And the monster's trying to protect him.
Cool. And you say it's four issues. And is this with Chuck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. And you're working on it now. Has the first issue, has it been solicited yet?
It'll be in the November solicitations.
Okay, so it'll be out.
So
next
the
year.
First issue will come out in February.
Oh, cool! So you have a lot of lead time. You're basically doing the entire series before. Well, how far are you? What issue are you in?
I'm working on the third book right now.
Okay, so you'll be done by the time they're solicited. I don't mean to put pressure on you, Graham.
I might be finished. You know, by the time the first issue's out, definitely everything will be done.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing that I have to do in between paying projects because I've actually been working on it a couple of years now.
Oh, really?
But I've just decided now it's never going to get done if I don't just take the time. So I've taken the last couple months off from everything, and I'm just plowing through it and trying to get it done.
Mm-hmm. And
when an occasional paying project comes up, I'll take it, jump on it for a little bit, you know, and then come back to it.
So even without a regular monthly gig, it sounds like your schedule is as busy as it's ever been.
Oh yeah, yeah, it is. It's always been busy though. I mean, I have to say, I've never been out of work in 30 years.
That's fantastic. I can't say that, and I don't draw anything.
Yeah, I've always something always crops up, or I put feelers out and something comes around, and I'm gonna knock on wood after saying that, but because you never know.
That's the life of a freelancer. Everything's going fine now.
Right.
Yeah, but who knows what next week will be. So, but it sounds like your schedule's at least booked until 2015.
I've got another project to do in September. So when I get this, my schedule is I'm going to get this third issue done. Mm-hmm. Then I have this other project I got to work on for Graphic India, and then I'll hop on the fourth issue and finish that.
No, cool. And are you inking that as well, Joe Frankenstein?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yep. Yep.
Now, how often?
It was my original concept, and I'm co-writing it with Chuck too.
Oh wow! How often do you ink your own work these days? Does it depend on the project?
I try to insist on it. Joe Kubert told me years ago, learn to ink your own work and then insist on doing it. Because it gives you full control of the artwork. Unless there's a reason for the assembly line method, then I usually insist on inking my own work.
And do you save time? Because I know some artists that doubles the time they spend on a page, and then other artists can do very loose pencils because they know what the inks are going to be. Where do you fall on?
I do loose pencils. I do them, 8.5 by 11. Then I put them into the computer and blow them up, and then convert it to a blue line, which is a non-repro color, and then print it out onto my actual artboard. And then from there, if anything needs tightening up, I'll do that with a blue pencil or just a regular pencil, whatever, and then I'll go right into the inks on it. Because I like to leave a certain amount to the interpretation of the inking so that there's an energy to the drawing. It doesn't look like it's been labored over and over and over. And then there's a looseness to it also that I think gives it more life.
And does starting on 8.5 by 11 save you time, or does it make you feel freer? Does it feel like you're just doing thumbnails and then blowing that up?
Yeah, yeah, it does. Especially if there's a bunch of perspective, because now my vanishing points are closer. I'm not out, two desks away. I can control that a little bit better. But if it's something a little more complicated, I'll put vanishing points in the computer. And put a grid in and get everything squared away that way. And that gets converted to blue line, and then I can tighten it up when I blow it up. But it does save me time to do it that way.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
Well, I'm marathoning the Planet of the Apes movies.
You know, every time I go on Amazon, it tells me that Graham Nolan liked A Planet of the Apes.
They had one of those blue dot deals or whatever, the gold box deals, and you could get all of the movies, all the original Blu-ray movies for $25.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, oh, I it went down to $20 for a while, and I had the first two, and while I was debating whether or not the final three were worth it, it went back up to 30, and I was like, well, now you've made my decision. Because it's weird. I don't know if it's coincides with you, but once I saw Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I wanted to go back and watch all those original movies again.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't seen the newest one. Is that Dawn?
Yeah, it's really good.
No, that's Rise. Rise.
Rise was the first one. Rise was the one they did with James Franco, which
oh,
I liked. Yeah, the one that's in the theater now is Dawn, and it is really good. I was it's actually
I haven't seen it yet.
It's worth it. It's actually a lot better than Rise, which I liked.
Yeah, I liked Rise, but it could be better. And I've heard that this one is really good, so I'm in on that. So
yeah, I thought Rise was an interesting science fiction movie, but it didn't really excite me. And Dawn does that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I love about it is that even though they've rebooted it and they're going their own timeline, they haven't done anything in either of these movies that has contradicted the original film. Now, the sequels are contradictory all over the place, but that that original Charlton Heston, Rod Serling script, which is so good, you could still see these new movies as prequels to that.
True. Yeah, it'd be cool if they brought Taylor into it somehow.
There is an Easter egg in Rise, and I didn't notice this, but a friend of mine told me there is a space launch on TV. When James Franco and John Lithgow are in the kitchen with Caesar.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yep.
Yeah, and they say the astronauts' names, and you see Taylor's name. So it could all still happen.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. What?
Yeah. So that's what I'm into right now. I've been watching those, and
Have you watched all five?
In the past, I have, but
not on the Blu-rays.
No, I'm on the third one right now.
I just finished the third one last night. They're also streaming on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly they slashed the budgets of that movie.
Yeah.
Because that third movie is literally just Cornelius and Zira walking around a back lot.
Yeah, and an old ship.
yeah, which I think is like one of the ship from one of the Dirty Harry movies.
Like, yeah, it might just be.
Yeah, somebody lent that out in films. It's like there was that tunnel in the late 80s that was in every Hollywood movie. It was the tunnel into Toonland in Roger Rabbit, and then it was also in Back to the Future, where Marty McFly had the hoverboard. And then I was watching Throw Mama from the Train again, and they used the same tunnel. And even my 7-year-old's like, I know this tunnel. I feel like that ship was the early 70s equivalent of that tunnel.
That's funny.
I share your Planet of the Apes obsession right now. I'm really tempted. Have you seen NECA has done a new line of Planet of the Apes figures that are they supposedly really good. They have Cornelius, Dr. Zaius, and a gorilla soldier. And I'm if they announce a Taylor, I'm going to have to get every one of them.
First time I saw Planet of the Apes, it was 1973. And my brother and I went to a double feature. It was the original Planet of the Apes with Battle for the Planet of the Apes. So I got to see the first one and the last one back-to-back as a double feature.
Wow.
That was really... Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember the Apes marathons. When I grew up in New York, it was always Thanksgiving week. They would show every Apes movie, and I saw pieces of them. And it wasn't till college. For some reason, HBO was rerunning the original one over and over and over again. And then when I saw it in college, I got what it was trying to do. Like, I finally figured out the satire of it. And then when I realized Rod Serling wrote the screenplay, I was like, wow, this is the longest, most expensive Twilight Zone ever made.
Yeah, exactly right.
Even with the twist ending, and then I fell in love with those. That's awesome. We're at the exact same point in life right now.
Now, where'd you grow up in New York?
I'm from Queens. I'm originally from Rockaway, and then
I grew up in Long Beach.
Oh, really? I have a lot of family in Long Beach now.
Really?
Yeah, but you're upstate now, right?
Yeah, I'm outside of Buffalo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I ended up, I grew up in Rockaway, and then I lived in Astoria for a long time, and then about 4 years ago, we came out to Chicago.
Oh, okay.
So, which is why I always have to do the math every time I talk to someone on the podcast in the East Coast. But it's been great talking to you, Graham. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been a lot of fun.
It has been. I've enjoyed it a lot, John. So I appreciate the invite, and thanks for asking cool questions.
No, thanks for the conversation. Now, how can people find you? I know you and I are Facebook friends, but I don't know if you have a fan page or a Twitter handle.
I do. I've got a website, GrahamNolan.com. I also have SunshineStateComics.com.
Is that a CS? Is that comics with a CS?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there's the also have the Joe Frankenstein page, which is JoeFrankenstein.com. And you can get to all of those pages at thegrahamnolan.com. So if you just go there, you can get to everything.
So right after I talked to Graham Nolan, I got a message from Chuck Dixon saying he had a new Kickstarter. And since the two of them had been teammates for so long, I thought it would be a great time to get a perspective from both of them. So let's talk to Chuck about his new Kickstarter project.
Yeah, it's for a graphic novel called Sword of Wood. Written by me, drawn by Estev Pauls, who I worked with on Lone Ranger and Man with No Name. It's a big medieval horror epic.
Now, since you guys had done Lone Ranger, and obviously you have a long list of credits, why Kickstarter instead of going to, say, like an IDW or a Dark Horse or an indie label?
Well, the way things work these days is... you kind of got to put it all together for them and then bring it to the independents. I mean, unless you have, a certain name or whatever, name recognition or marquee value.
You don't have a certain name?
No, I don't have. I'm not one of those A-level guys. So, and the other thing is, because you're bringing it to them free, you really don't have to pit or do anything like that. Yeah, you just put it together the way you want it.
Right.
So
then the idea is that the Kickstarter is to fund the production of it, and then you'll take it into an independent, or are you planning on self-publishing?
No, I'll probably end up taking it to an independent because I don't want to I'm not a publisher. I don't know how to do that. They do that. They market, they publish. That's their art. I mean, we've got about 30 pages of it done, so we're well into it. We just need some cash, to get it going.
Well, how long is it going to be?
Between 100 and 120 pages, trade paperback length. I mean, that's what the length for American graphic novels are these days. So that's what we're aiming at.
So you think about 4 or 5 issues, or are you planning on putting it out as like a hardcover right away?
I don't know. Again, that would be up to a publisher as the best way they could market it. I would imagine it would be 4 or 5 issues. It was broken down into a monthly book. Mm-hmm. But, I'm just as happy going right for the graphic novel and for the full story digitally, as I said, the publishers know the market better than I do.
Right. So what's the story? What is the?
It's about a crusader in the First Crusades who becomes basically, homesick. And he's thinking, here we are, we're out here fighting. I haven't been home in years and years and years. I don't, I miss my wife. I miss my kids. And he returns home to find that his whole manor has been basically stripped bare by someone or something, and his wife and children are gone. And basically he's left to pursue an army of the undead which are traveling across the country like a plague.
And, oh, wow.
He's not sure if his wife and kids are alive or being held hostage or are among the undead. So what sets this apart is that it is an army of the undead led by, you know, some unholy bastard. And they're waging medieval war as they go along. It's like a total war set in a Middle Ages setting. So it's a little different. It's not a bunch of guys creeping around in the dark with our hero hunting them down. He literally has to face an army.
Right. It's more like Aragorn in Return of the King than The Walking Dead.
Yeah. Yeah. They're a bit more organized.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more to it, but you reach a point where you don't want to spoil your own story.
Especially when it's not finished.
Especially when it's not finished. I mean, in my head, it's all done and it's gorgeous. But it's it does it is different. It does have the hook of being more epic in scale than these things usually are.
Right, and I looked on the Kickstarter page, and your artist is Estev Poles. Am I saying that right?
Yes, yes.
He's got a very classic sense. It reminds me of some of the old Savage Sword of Conan's, or even some of the, like, a little bit of Bernie Wrightson kind of. It's very illustrative.
Yeah, he's as much into the homework as I am, and he used to do a lot of war comics, a lot of period comics, and he can draw horses, which is tough, but both of us are research nuts, so everything's going to look as accurate as we can possibly make it, and for my money. The more accurate you make it, the more exotic it looks, because you just can't think up stuff as cool as the stuff really looked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Estev, is he in Spain now?
Yeah, he's from Spain. We've never met. We've worked together quite a bit. He's doing an arc on Winterworld as well.
Oh, cool. Does he speak English?
I don't think so.
Oh, so is he
translating?
Wow, is he translating your scripts?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he has a translator over there. I deal with him through his agency. So
that's cool. Now, have you worked with many artists that you haven't met before? I know you and Graham are good friends, but is that unusual that you've never met an artist, never had a conversation with him, and just had the script go out?
Yeah. Some artists they need more communication, and then others seem to work fine without it. I'm always open for questions. I'm flexible. I'm willing to collaborate. But some guys are good to go with the script. So yeah, there's quite a few artists, sadly, that I've worked with quite a bit and never spoken to.
Wow. Now Scott Mednix is also involved.
How
is Scott involved?
Well, I'm good friends with the two guys that run Framelight. An agency, and I just mentioned Sword of Wood to them, and they went nutty over it. And then they represented me and ran across Scott, who was interested in the project. And I've spoken to him a number of times, and we seem to have the same vision for it. But like so many projects in Hollywood, it begins with a graphic novel. It's like, you got to get that done first.
So they want to see a finished published piece before it moves forward as, say, a potential movie.
Yeah, because quite frankly, it's much cheaper to do a graphic novel than it is to develop a film.
Oh yeah, it's two guys.
Yeah, it's me writing, another guy drawing, which is a lot easier than the army they put together to put the stuff. The guys that make a lot more money than I do.
Now, and has there been much talk from Scott about what this would be when it's finished, or are you going to wait for it to be finished, whether it would be, say, a miniseries or a feature film or an animated film?
He's talking feature film, and he's talking kind of talking my language, because he wanted to make it realistic looking, mm-hmm. not CGI driven.
Yeah, so live action.
Yeah, live action, real world, not a delirium, because I know he was involved with 300, but he doesn't want that kind of look for it. He wants a more of a real world, less delirious look for it.
Right. And as we said, Estev has a much more realistic style than Frank Miller does.
So, yeah. It's more mainstream, just direct, deliberate storytelling.
Yeah, well, it sounds cool. So how can people donate to the Kickstarter?
They can go to Kickstarter.com. They can Google my name in Kickstarter. They can Google Sword of Wood. They can go to my Facebook page. There's a ton of links. We're trying to get the word out. And, you know, any spare change they have in the sofa cushions, or even if people just want to spread the word about it, it's greatly appreciated.
It'd be nice if people had a coin slot on their laptops.
Or just, you know, stick the credit card in. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, just get a square.
But right now it's simple, you know. You point and click, and you know, how many tchotchkes do you want for your money? Hopefully, people will contribute just because they want to see it done.
Right, and it's not a huge amount of money.
No. We're bargain basing, you know, because like I said, a lot of the artwork's already done. So
right.
We just need to get to the finish line.
And will this be in color? Because I see there's like grayscale. It looks almost like grayscale watercoloring from the samples that are on the Kickstarter page.
Yeah, I think that would depend on who we can find, you know, for color. You know, I think Estev is trying to, you know, a lot of artists, Butch Geist puts a lot of gray tones in as well, mm-hmm. you know, just to indicate to the colorist, you know, have a little bit more control over the tonal quality of the finished product. But yeah, I imagine it would be in color.
Right. So you haven't chosen one direction or the other.
No.
Well, great. Well, we got a couple weeks, so you can find it right now, and you have time if you have to wait for a paycheck, I think, to donate.
Don't we all?
Yeah. But yeah, as I said, Chuck, anytime you have something like this, I would expect you would come here for it. And we'll talk about it. Is there anything you want to say to Graham Nolan just because you guys are on the same show? And I'm assuming you will both listen to the episode.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I don't.
And I get the last word.
You do. I don't know if you've listened to the two episodes you've been on yet.
No, he's a good buddy. He's a good guy. And, you know, we've been working together for quite a few years, you know, for a reason, because I think we both use the wrong part of our brain in the same way. And we see the world the same way, which is kind of frightening. But no, he's an awesome guy, and I love collaborating with him. And it is a total organic collaboration. It's pretty cool.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.